Hello and welcome to the Journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Today, we're talking about Community Engagement 2.0, a framework for meeting the needs of your immediate community, whether you define that as something geographic, identity-based, and/or experiential. That's a term coined by Anita Lee, who runs a hyperlocal solutions-focused news outlet called The Green Line out in Canada, which launched in 2022. To many news outlets, community engagement is about listening, identifying, and delivering on needs. But there's an extra step you might be missing: making sure the stories make a tangible difference to people's lives. In other words, it's about getting the community to engage with the world around them, not just the news. We'll learn about how Anita does that in her four-step process she calls the Action Journey Model. Here, she's been able to design and develop a number of unorthodox but very handy news products. Products that are informed and tailor-made for her community in Toronto. That's all coming up, so don't go anywhere. A big thanks to Memberful for sponsoring today's episode, the all-in-one membership solution for journalists and independent publishers. Now, it is so important these days to build loyal relationships with your readers and diversify your revenue streams. Memberful helps you to do exactly that with a range of different payment tiers and exclusive content options at your fingertips. Plus, it will integrate easily with all the tools you already use, like WordPress, MailChimp, Google Analytics, and Discord, so you can start monetizing your content without changing your existing workflow. Focus on telling great stories and let Memberful handle the rest. Visit memberful.com, that's memberful.com/journalismpod to get started for free. Anita, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. A pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Anita, today we're going to talk about this really fascinating concept that you're thinking about right now, Community Engagement 2.0. Mm-hmm. You're based in Toronto,
yes,
which is a major metropolitan city in the world and a highly multicultural city as well. So in a place like Toronto, what exactly does this word community mean? That's where I'd like to start.
Yeah, absolutely. So the concept of audiences and communities can be conflated, right?
Yeah.
But an audience is something that a newsroom targets, right? But a community is something that already exists inherently in any sort of area, town, metropolitan center. And so the way I distinguish, or the way I define communities, is within three buckets largely. One is geographic. So we're talking about a neighborhood. I live in the neighborhood of Greenwood, Coxwell, in the city of Toronto. That is a distinct community that has shared understanding of, like, just geography. A lot of my neighbors and I go to the similar stores and restaurants in the area, for example. Then there's a second community or type of community that I identify, which is identity-based. So you mentioned how, you know, multicultural and very pluralistic Toronto is in Canada by extension. And I am, for example, a member of the Chinese Canadian community, or more specifically Hong Kong Canadian community, because I'm of Hong Kong descent. My parents are from there, in Toronto. And so there's obviously a distinct kind of cultural understanding and shared identity between that community. For example, we're all celebrating Lunar New Year this month. And then finally, I always talk about a community of, you know, shared experience. So we're talking about people who are formerly incarcerated, for example, or people who are military veterans. They have a really distinct experience that not a lot of other people share. So that obviously creates a sense of collegiality, or at least shared understanding or shared values, ultimately.
Mm. I didn't really think about the experience one so much coming into this, Anita. I think that's quite interesting. And what I sense with a lot of those definitions you provide is there's room, there's wiggle room there for some overlap, right? If you're talking about a racial community within a geographical area, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So that's a really good example, because there's, you know, diasporic communities, many different diasporic communities in Toronto, and there's waves of immigration. So, for example, my parents came here in the 70s and the 80s. They oftentimes migrated to, you know, the suburbs of Toronto. Chinese folks who came earlier, you know, than us in the early 1900s often settled in the downtown core. Those are, you know, differentiated geographies as well as distinct kind of cultural identities as well, because the folks who came in the 70s and 80s were often from Hong Kong. The folks who came earlier might have come from an island called Taishan in China, for example. And obviously, I don't want to be reductive about people's experiences. Like, there's so many different intersections that they all kind of interplay ultimately.
That makes a lot of sense to me. What about, how do I ask this question? Is it possible to create a community from scratch?
I would say no. I would say it's something that even when we talk about careers, like I'm a journalist, or hobbies, like I'm somebody who plays piano. Those are things that have existed for a long, long time. And I think like there is very rarely something, although it does exist, like there might be like pickleball is a newer thing. And maybe you're somebody who's a pickleball like enthusiast. You like to play it a lot. And maybe somehow you're one of the earliest group of people who made this like a popular sporting like activity in Toronto. Perhaps then you'd be a gatekeeper within that community. But very often, like I said, communities are already things that exist that you then elect to be, to identify with or be part of.
So what have we learned so far? A community can be defined as quite a few different things. It's mainly based on geography, identity, or experience. Historically, media has targeted the more monetizable audience segments, typically wealthier and more overrepresented groups, leaving other communities marginalized and underserved. That creates an information disparity that many new media outlets have looked to address. They have scaled on the engagement 1.0 model of identifying and serving communities through the journalism they produce. But Anita says the job isn't done there. Community engagement 2.0 provides one more step, which should seek to provide practical solutions to everyday problems, to engage with the world around them rather than simply engaging with the news. We're going to find out how the Green Line does this now through its action journey model, a four-step process of producing explainers, features, events, and then ultimately a solution-centered story.
And essentially what it is, it's a four-step process to get people to take action on the issues that they care about most. So in a given month, we tackle one systemic issue facing the city. In week one, we publish an explainer that breaks down the systemic problem. Week two, we publish an in-depth solutions-focused feature story that reports on existing solutions to this problem. It could be in the form of a data interactive, series of short-form stories, long-form piece of journalism, a documentary, really anything. Then we have an event where we convene members of the public, community members, sources from the story, experts to discuss the problem as well as solutions and pathways forward. And we conduct community surveying at those events to be able to aggregate this information or curate it. And then in week four, we publish a solutions article that reflects the top solutions that emerge from the community members at the event. And so there's a bit of data journalism embedded there where we basically analyze the data and then we identify, okay, these are the solutions that people are the most keen on or have been the most effective. And so the solutions article is really critical because we also not only reflect solutions back to the community members, so it's a bottom-up thing. We're not being paternalistic or telling people what to do or advocating. We are absolutely not an advocacy journalism organization. We are also providing resources that enable them to take action on the solutions they've identified.
I'll tell you what I take from that, Anita, is that community engagement models of the past sought to, you know, connect with communities to simply try and get news in front of them. Really, that's not effective anymore. You need to engage with these communities and then be open to the possibility of what they want may completely be at odds with the product you already have.
Yes.
Am I on the right lines?
Yeah, that is the right lines. I would also say there's a component of this that it's not just even about the content. I think what you're talking about actually still is more in the lines of community engagement 1.0.
Right.
It's not just a matter of us producing something that they tell us they want, which is community engagement 1.0. It's about us enabling them to use this information and deliberately encouraging them to take the information to do something about it, whether it's advocating for themselves through voting or protesting or enacting some sort of policy change or mutual aid. Maybe it's a matter of coming together to come up with a solution that the government is not providing them with, for example. That is really the distinction between the two. It's that extra step. It's no longer about the content that we produce. It's really not even really about us. It's not even that this is a newfangled idea. This is actually going back to our fundamentals and brass tacks. I remember seeing old clips of the Globe and Mail during the 1918 Spanish flu, and they were basically curating or putting out ads for, you know, home nurses to help people in their homes, like So that is like taking a really active role in organizing the public to support each other during a time of crisis. And obviously, I think like many countries around the world are experiencing crisis. So this is something that we need to come back to.
It's not about us, is something you just said. And that kind of hit me quite hard, Anita, in that it's really about the outcome. I think let's take a tangible example of this, because we're talking a lot, you know, in, you know, theoretical terms, but actually you're doing the real work on the other side of this, on the Green Line. And there's many great examples of news products you've come up with that I think really speak to this point about, you know, tangible results for communities. I look at your website and I see guides, I see maps of food banks, I see, you know, checklists and cost of living calculators. So walk me through some of the products you've come up with this kind of community engagement 2.0 model in mind, and you know, follow through for me exactly how you hope those arrive at a tangible outcome for communities.
Yeah, I'll give you an example from this month. The theme of this issue is how to deal with evictions in Toronto. So this is tied to our, you know, very broad and urgent housing crisis in the city. So at the events this month, which happened just last Tuesday, or this past Tuesday, what I did was I invited a housing organizer who was able to successfully fight unfair evictions from landlords and has successfully also organized other tenant associations to do the same. So I asked him to give a very practical step-by-step presentation of how he was able to execute this. So that is one example of, you know, bringing in a resource. In addition to that, I invited a tenants association, a legal kind of aid clinic when it comes to housing evictions or just housing rights in general, and in a community land trust organization to serve as resource tables. So they basically were at the perimeter of the event. They disseminated, you know, pamphlets and brochures, and they were there to answer questions of the attendees that came to our event. So again, like providing concrete resources. And part of this also included a conversation, something I call story circles, which are facilitated conversations that are targeted about the problem and then the solution to this issue, in this case, it was evictions. So it was also a way for people to build community, to feel less isolated, because obviously you can feel quite isolated if you're getting evicted. And then for them to develop a support network of other people who have been going through the same thing. So this is, you know, tangibly, not just, you know, we're not just presenting our journalism and saying like, hey, look at the news products we produce. It's also gathering people and then connecting them directly with the resources. So it's not just them Googling by themselves at 3 a.m. in anxiety. So that's one thing. The other thing is the news products we produce. So we, for example, have created a checklist for how to fight an above guideline rent increase. So what we did was we interviewed a woman who was able to successfully do that for her building. And then what we did was we distilled the reporting into a two-pager that ultimately read like three phases. The way I describe it is the actions were escalating. So it's like the lowest hanging fruit thing you can do to the most intense thing you can do to fight an above guideline rent increase. So rather than kind of Googling this information, there's a checklist that you can just consult that's backed up by reporting and data. Another thing that we've done, for example, is we produced a 5-part series that essentially walked people through like different components of what they might have to deal with if they are encountering an eviction. So things like what happens after you get an eviction notice, dealing with N4s. So this is a type of notice that you receive. So that's when you're behind on rent. Dealing with N12, which is when your landlord wants to sell or move into your unit. So we're talking about very specific notices or documents that receive. So it's very, very practical. It distills it to like, okay, I'm stressing out about this thing. What does it mean? And what do I do in this scenario?
I hope our listeners are really getting a sense that these are quite unorthodox news products, right? Really in the grand scheme of things, but it's, should they really be considered that way? Because really the outcome is very, very helpful for news audiences. If they want to know where's my nearest food bank, and they can look up a little, you know, geolocated map to see what's around the corner from them. Mm-hmm. And I do just want to ask, like, how much of an assumption was it on your part that these were resources that your community needed versus how much sort of research and digging did you have to do prior to making these to make sure they were viable?
So it's a combination of both. And that's where the community engagement 1.0 comes in. I won't get into the nitty gritty detail, but of course, when you start a new startup, you have to editorial is more top down because you don't have the infrastructure yet to, for example, in our case, consult communities at a broad scale or do it consistently because it's really just me in the beginning. But now at this point, when I have 2 full-time staff and 12 staff in total, including part-time staff, it enables us to be able to bake into our model more consistent consulting of communities. So that's my long way of saying that a lot of what we produce is based on the feedback of our community members at events, at our engagement outposts that we have. We have one in downtown where we basically disseminate surveys and we have conversations with people in a particular neighborhood in downtown Toronto. And that has definitely informed our journalism. The other thing I do want to say is like one of the things that we've done this year is refined our model in the sense that we focus on 5 pillars of livability. So it's housing, jobs, commuting, which includes transit and driving, health, and food, basically. So The reason why I mention this is because we have 12 months in a year. The first half of the year, we basically tackle those 5 pillars, and then we also tackle them again in the second half of the year. And the information that we gather, or the feedback we gather from our community members in the first half of the year informs our action journeys in the second half of the year. So the whole idea is like, I'm hoping that at some point we have a very holistic coverage of these 5 pillars. So this month we're, you know, focusing on evictions in the city of Toronto. And in the second half of the year, when we do another housing action journey, it would be another component of the housing crisis that our community members have identified as something that they really want us to focus on. Mm.
Do people care about these resources? Do they genuinely use them? Do you see this on the other side of the numbers, that people are opening these and using them in some way?
So we're a young publication. We're close to 3 years old. I would say the trend is like, yes, but the thing that I can unequivocally say has been impactful and that people find really valuable are the events, which I consider a journalistic output. And the kind of feedback that we get about the information that we provide at the events, the kind of community that we build at the events have been really just overwhelmingly positive. And in fact, at our most recent evictions event, somebody told us that they were quite cynical coming in. They're like, what can I actually learn from this? And they walked away feeling a lot more relieved about their situation, that they had kind of a pathway forward.
Were you wrong about anything? Did you make anything and people didn't really care about it, or you didn't get the engagement you would have liked?
Yeah, I mean, certainly this is why we refined our approach in the third year. Absolutely. Part of the reason why I decided to focus on 5 pillars of livability was because I was kind of stabbing in the dark in the beginning. I was kind of throwing things at the wall in the sense that, for example, we did action journeys on Toronto's basketball scene. We did something on the queer communities and trade. It was like there'd be certain things that I would get pitched from reporters and I'd say, let's build an action journey around it. And then I'd realize that there isn't really a need for, say, local basketball players in the city. Like, in my head, I was like, okay, well, this is a distinct group that has a shared experience in the city, and maybe they don't have access to like accessible venues to practice. But it was just like clearly not something that was a need. And so for me, over time, I realized like, well, what are the things that are the most urgent, that are bipartisan, that just have to do with people surviving in the city? And so I came with, you know, when you're talking about shelter, you're talking about food, you're talking about physical and mental health. That's how I landed on that. And so we're basically testing that hypothesis now. I think it's already proven to be a lot more successful than like our previous action journeys.
Just a quick one from me. Our next digital journalism conference, News Rewired, is happening on the 13th of May at News UK in London. This is a fantastic opportunity to network with your peers in the news industry and stay on top of the latest trends like scaling an audience-first media business. You're in luck as well, as today, 6th of February, is your last chance to take advantage of our early bird offer, saving you £40. To grab your place today, head to newsrewired.com and we'll see you there. One thing that's certainly come through today is that, you know, this is quite a selfless endeavor in many ways. You know, you really are going out of your way to serve a community. You went as far as earlier to say, you know, it's not about us, but I'm sure the folks listening in are probably thinking, well, how do I make this work for my media business and not go out of business in the process? So
absolutely.
Talk to me about the viability and sustainability element here. How have you made this work as a business, frankly?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, for all the listeners out there, as much as I'm somebody who's mission-focused journalist, I'm also a pragmatic business person. And so I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't have time with my husband and my friends and my hobby. The Green Line's actually been profitable 2 years in a row, and our profit continues to grow. So I describe our model as a civic partnerships model. If any of you are familiar with the publication El Tiempo No in the United States, it's quite similar to that model in that our main revenue source, and we have a very diversified revenue source, but our main revenue source is through partnerships. So I have a partnership with City News Toronto, which is a major broadcaster in the city, and Yahoo. And that provides me with sustainable monthly revenue in addition to, like, membership is also a slice of the revenue pie as well. The partners that we have range from cultural institutions to other media entities to grassroots community organizations, and they all have different purposes. So some of the revenue that we generate for them from them can be direct, like in the case of City and Yahoo, but some are indirect. So we partnered with places like the Boys and Girls Club of Scarborough, East Scarborough, or FoodShare, which is a food advocacy organization. And because we're a for-profit business, we're for-profit mission-focused, we've often partnered with charities, for example, to serve as our trustees to unlock foundation funding. So that's why foundation funding is actually a slice of our revenue pie, even though that's atypical for for-profit businesses, because usually you have to be a nonprofit, at least in Canada. So that has been hugely helpful, not just from an editorial kind of imperative, because obviously the organizations we're partnering with also have an inroad into the communities we want to serve, but also from a business, like practical business perspective as well. So that has been fantastic and has opened up, like I said, not just partner revenue, but foundation revenue. There's small amounts of corporate sponsorship. I'm just looking at our revenue chart right now. And then government revenue. But I want to also make a distinction that we are very editorially independent. So I know many journalists out there that are listening might be like, okay, how are you getting government funding and not feeling uncomfortable about it? The cool thing about the Green Line is that I pitched the Action Journey as a product. So I'm actually not selling content, which is a huge distinction and actually protects your journalism. So when you actually say you're pitching a product that is an experience like the Action Journey, mm-hmm. it's essentially like an experience, a funnel. You're really protecting the journalism. You're not like exchanging the money for a feature, and they're not having a say in that. And then the last thing I'll say is I also have other direct B2C funding. So we're talking about memberships, donations, events, and merchandise as well.
That's a nice little workaround that you've found there for yourself, Anita. I mean, and just for clarity, the philanthropic market is not in Canada is not where it is in the States. Yes. It's like here in the UK, it's pretty yes by comparison.
Absolutely.
Right? So we're not talking about a huge culture of philanthropy here where this has been made available. I'm sure this hasn't fallen on your lap though. So I do just wonder how you've been able to, generate those opportunities for yourself in the Green Line.
The funding opportunities, you mean?
Yeah.
So one element is like my own personal history. Like I've been a journalist for the better part of 2 decades. And so I've worked at all the major publications like The Globe, The Star, CBC. It's why I was able to strike up a partnership with City so quickly. It was because they knew me by reputation. So that is an element of it that I want to acknowledge explicitly. So some of the earliest partners that I had were community organizations from places that I grew up in. So for example, I mentioned Boys and Girls Club of East Scarborough. Scarborough is a suburb of Toronto that is my hometown. I understand their pain points, what they celebrate. I understand like the geographic makeup of that area. So when I had those initial conversations, I was really persuasive. And so when you have a place like Boys and Girls Club of East Scarborough, that's been a charity for the better part of 70 years since the 1950s. And you're able to go to other people and say, okay, well, if BGC Scarborough trusts the Green Line, like, that really incentivizes me to do the same. So it was very much like, I really had to not hit the ground running. I really had to put in the on the ground effort. But because I knew the messaging I was coming in with, I also understood inherently the needs, like I said, of those communities. They bought in pretty quickly. And then from there, it just kind of grew.
Love that. What's next for the Green Line?
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, we're really picking up steam, which I'm really excited about. But what I'm hoping to do is actually produce journalism more consistently. So we're not a daily publication, but I went from producing six action journeys last year in the first 2 years of existence, now producing close to a dozen, between 10 to 12 this year. And we also, it's basically this new refined approach to the action journey model was based on testing a hypothesis across 2 years. So now this is the next phase. We refined our strategy a bit further. We've really focused in on what we do well, which is, like I said, brass tacks, service-oriented journalism, and these events that I'm talking about. So we're really trying to elevate that experience for our members and also just broader community members and members of the public. So that's really what we're focusing on. So this year, we're launching a membership campaign in the spring. So I'm really hoping to broaden out that particular slice of the revenue pie. Because as you know, funding can be, from larger donors, can be quite fickle, especially in the economic climate that we're currently in. And so this is why I was really strategic about getting as many, you know, diversifying my revenue sources and getting many sources as possible or streams as possible, because I'd never want to put my publication in a position where it's unsustainable or precarious. So that's really the next goal, is like the most kind of sustainable revenue is directly from the audiences you serve.
Busy.
Yeah. Quite busy.
Well, you'll have to keep me in the know.
Yes.
Good luck with it all. And thanks so much for doing this, Anita. Really was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Jacob.
Loads of lessons today. But I think one takeaway for me is this. It's not about the news. Communities, especially those underserved, often seek out practical value on how to navigate their lives. There's some nice cutouts from our conversation too. Anita's five pillars of democracy: housing, jobs, commuting, health, and food. These are five immediate areas of need that geographic communities especially likely need addressing. And the action journey model again, four parts across 4 weeks: an explainer unpacking a systemic issue, an in-depth feature reporting on existing solutions, an event to discuss and survey those solutions, and then an article with the top action points and accompanying resources. Give it a go and let me know how it pans out. I'm on LinkedIn the most, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.